You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 10th of March 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show...
Build that wall! Build that wall! Build that wall! Build that wall! Build that wall!
But if you do build it, will they continue to come anyway? My guests Carlotta Rebello, Tom Edwards and Daniel Giacopelli will be here to discuss that and the day's other big stories, including the identity crisis apparently besetting the entire Western world as diagnosed by Bill Clinton, plus...
We have to have sustainable electricity production as well as consumption.
Elon Musk's offer to switch South Australia's lights back on. And might more people join the church if it offered greater opportunities to dress schnauzers up as monks? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24. So, welcome to Midori House. My guests today are Tom Edwards, executive producer of Monocle 24, Daniel Giacopelli, producer-presenter for Monocle 24, and Carlotta Rebello, producer for Monocle 24. Welcome all. Now, having heard in recent weeks more than sufficient from the 45th President of the United States, we're going to start by discussing the thoughts of the 42nd. In his first major public appearance since failing to become First Gentleman of the US to launch a biography of Yitzhak Rabin, Bill Clinton made the plausible but depressing observation that the Middle East of recent times, a rancorous mess of paranoid tribalism and sentimental nationalist fantasies, may be a precursor of the Europe and America of the near future. On that happy thought, it strikes me that we have four different passports gathered around this table. Are you, my fellow guests, experiencing yourselves personally, individually in your lives, a sort of resurgence of a
tribalism?
Passionate nativist, isolationist, etc., etc.?
Tom, maybe take this one away. As somebody representing the former British Empire.
Well, no, the irony, of course, being that I am the only person sitting in my country of birth, in my country of nationhood, and the three of you very much conform with our general Monocle worldview. The world's a small place. People should travel to broaden the mind and to work and to do business and all this sort of thing. I worry a little about this. I think what's interesting is people have very short memories and they have a tendency to forget, and they have a tendency to neglect the importance of, well, recent history and sort of middle distance history. Not talking about athletics. If you think about Europe, you know, it has been a pretty extraordinary period since World War II, give or take some pretty obvious
Yugoslavia,
which I think are important to say. For the most part, you know, the majority of the population across the whole block has lived in relative peace and security. And I think, you know, it goes right back to the summer of last year and the Brexit vote and all that. I think people have probably become complacent about that.
But I think it comes to a more important question, that is, because Europe has enjoyed that peace for 70-odd years, a lot of the people today were generations born in peace, born in democracy, after dictatorial regimes have failed. In my case, Portugal, you know, it's one of the last dictatorships to end in Europe, and that was 40 years ago. You have generations born after that, and it's easy to take something for granted when you haven't known anything else other than that.
No, I don't really subscribe to that. I mean, I just think it's too recent, and the impact of that history is too stark for too many people. I understand that, yeah, people weren't literally around. But surely people's memories, they can't be so blinkered as to the prevailing circumstances.
Danny, the peoples of Europe, as any sort of survey of their history will reveal, are a fairly querulous lot who do enjoy a good tear-up reasonably regularly. And as Tom and Carlotta point out, they've gone 70 years without one. But we see a lot of the same sentiment at large in the United States, and actually, to be honest now that I think of it, in Australia. And these are two countries to whom... You know, there is no, we don't really have it. Australia doesn't even have any neighbours at all. The United States has really only two. But both countries, there is no imaginable threat to their security or sovereignty or sense of national pride. And yet, that nativist paranoia still exists. Where does it come from in America?
Well, you say that. But I mean, if you were living on the southern border, you would argue that undocumented migrants coming over the border does kind of disturb your daily existence. The paranoia, where does it come from? I mean, well, essentially, if you're looking at what Bill Clinton said, so he said, basically, if you delegitimize the idea of the nation state and the idea of institutionalized internal conflict in nation after nation after nation is not the wisest strategy to pursue. So Clinton was actually saying that this is an international thing. Where people in various countries all around the world are saying, screw the nation state, we're going to break stuff. And it's just, it's populism wrought on a very large scale. So it's not just the US, it's everywhere.
But is the argument, Carlotta, and this is possibly the argument that the populists, the nativist populists would make, that it's the EU itself that said, screw the nation state by doing away with things such as borders. This, to insert my own prejudices into discussion, was one of the reasons I was always had reservations about the idea of free movement within the EU, in that it was always going to have this effect. It was always going to give life to organizations like UKIP or the Front National, Alternative for Deutschland, or, you know, whoever the local franchise is.
Well, I see your point, but I don't exactly agree with it. I think free movement, as with anything, it has its ups and downs. It has its good things and the bad things. And I speak for myself, of a generation that has only known that. And I don't want to be banging on about it. But the truth is that personally, and when I look back to Portugal, I can only see good reasons to this free movement. I mean, even when there was a border with Spain, it was almost non-existent. And the fact that I could be in Lisbon and say, let's just go from Spain to Madrid for lunch, it sounds so normal for us. And when I tell that to other friends, or when I speak to my American friends, friends from India or even from the Netherlands, that doesn't make sense. And it's such a notion that, you know, we're all in it together. If we can have peace in a continent, if we can have no borders so that we can go study abroad, I can decide to pack my bags and come to London and work. And if it doesn't work out in 3 hours, I'm in a different country. Why should that be a bad thing?
Tom, there's been some chat from the European Parliament's chief Brexit negotiator, Guy Verhofstadt, one of the two. He wants to make it possible for Britons to be able to apply after Brexit on an individual basis for some EU rights. So a Briton who wishes to continue to travel and study and live abroad could apply to do that. But is there any imaginable way that the other 27 countries are going to allow any compromise of that sort? Because the thing is, and I know that nobody here disagrees with this, Britain already had the best imaginable deal it was ever going to possibly get from the EU.
Well, that latter point you make, you know, reminds me again of those summer narratives and people saying, well, you know, don't worry, we'll be able to negotiate X and Y and Z. And it was plainly never the case. And that case was made at the time, but that's another story. Look, I think it will be very difficult for such freedoms to be negotiated. I can't imagine why the other 27 would be in the market for that unless they take a more holistic, joined-up view and look at what is best for the wider European bloc and community and actually show, I don't know, a bit more enlightenment and say, actually, despite the fact that Britain has given us a bloody nose, in effect, we won't offer the same back and we'll continue to see and support the positives that come from welcoming, I don't know, the best British students into Europe or the brightest minds to do business more easily. That is purely wishful thinking. I don't think it will happen because there's too many people who are small-minded and, again, will be looking to land blows for their domestic audience. And this is the reason why I think, Andrew, take what you said. You know, I always foresaw problems with this idea of, you know, ever greater integration. The currency was beset by problems because ultimately people can't make decisions without their local interests. And I don't think it's practical to expect them to do that.
What's interesting on that is that if it were to happen that you can opt in as a citizen to have EU citizenship, or at least some of the rights that come with citizenship, that makes me think of Jean-Claude Juncker's remarks, I think yesterday, the president of the European Commission, where he was saying that he does hope that one day Britain will rejoin the EU and that he can see that happening at some stage. Now, I think, as you, he has a lot of wishful thinking in there. But if that associated membership for citizens happens, it would make more an easier process for that eventually, that coming back to the EU.
Well, let's not forget, we were told when we joined the EC or whatever it was called in it, whenever we joined, that, you know, get this decision right because it's forever. And here we are, we're going to exit. If you can leave something that was forever, presumably you can rejoin it.
Well, this topic will probably come up again once or twice over the next couple of years. So let's look now at Australia, specifically South Australia, which has recently been plagued by blackouts so persistent that even other Australians are getting tired of making the joke about the last person leaving Adelaide having actually turned out the lights. But help purports to be at hand in the person of Elon Musk. The American tech billionaire with the Bond villain name has offered to solve the problem in 100 days or deliver the apparently necessary 100 megawatt battery storage system, whatever that is, for nothing. Danny, should South Australia take him up on this offer?
Yeah, why not? What could possibly go wrong, Andrew?
am I the only one who keeps getting flashbacks to that episode of The Simpsons where the monorail salesman comes to town?
So for those who don't know, yeah. No, I don't think this is... I mean, Elon Musk is a serious guy who puts his money where his mouth is. I mean, he really is. He's not some con man like in The Simpsons episode who is selling some kind of snake oil. That being said, if it all does go wrong, who do you blame? Do you blame the company? Do you blame the government? But, I mean... We're seeing much more private-public partnerships these days. I mean, look at NASA. I mean, it's using, I mean, SpaceX. Again, Elon Musk, he's the guy who's sending, he wants to send people to the moon. And I think private companies doing things like this is on whole a good thing.
Tom, we were talking in this space not long ago about IKEA stepping up with an idea it had for making refugee shelters, which could be unfurled and erected, well, in theory, as is with the case with IKEA materials, in theory, quickly and easily. But do we have to start being more imaginative about what we allow what we allow private corporations to do in the public sphere? This argument has been going on for some while, of course, and we saw the Labour government of Tony Blair was a big fan of public-private initiatives, not all of which I think it's fair to say were outstanding successes, and some of which, you know, our great-great-grandchildren will still be paying off.
Well, but this is it. I think you need to make a clear distinction between public-private partnership in that sense, which is a book-fiddling exercise to make things look like they're not costing you anything now, and they merely cost exactly what they would have cost, plus the addition of usually pretty prohibitive interest. And over the last few years, in a low interest rate environment, it has made ever less sense for governments to do that. Nevertheless, they continue to do it because it's a balance sheet exercise. I guess the difference between what Musk is proposing here is, look, you know, I've got the megawatt batteries you need to fix your problem, and you can take them from me, and if it doesn't work straight away, then we're quids out and you don't owe me anything. My only reservation about that is that it looks too good to be true, and I can't quite remember the old adage about if things look too good to be true. One other thing to bear in mind is how willing are local, regional, federal government going to be to get him on board, even if he solves it for no money? How bad does that make them look? And well, I think that's possibly the key block to them actually agreeing to go ahead.
This does raise a number of questions, that being one of them. I should stress that having no electricity at the height of a South Australian summer is no joke at all. In Adelaide, it can regularly climb over 42, 43 degrees. And this particular summer was a nasty one, got even hotter than that. You want the air conditioning to work at that point. But Carlotta, is there... I guess issues with the private sector undermining the public sector at a number of levels, especially when you're talking about something as, you know, absolutely vital as energy infrastructure. You have a government which can't seem to control it. And the idea of outsourcing it not merely to a private company, but a foreign private company, are there difficulties here?
Well, sometimes what happens is even you having private investors or foreign investors, I should say, buying state-owned companies. That happened in Portugal, where Chinese investors bought the sole energy provider. Like, our energy is controlled by a different country, and it was used to be state-owned. And I think that even raises a bigger question about when is it too much. In this case, and I do understand that there are ways that the private sector and businesses can fill a gap that the government can't, be it bureaucracy, trying to get everyone on board and around the same table to agree. But there needs to be a limit to that.
This is great. It's turning the entire table into paranoid pull-up-the-drawbridge nativists.
I think I was halfway there already.
I mean, Danny, is the...
Come on, it's a good thing, guys. It's a good thing.
But you would say that. You're American and therefore somehow in league with them, probably.
Yeah, I have shares in SolarCity.
Well, exactly. But would America, and I'm braced for somebody pointing out that this is probably already the case, but would it be, is this something you could sell in America, the idea of energy infrastructure being owned by outside interests?
Well,
clearly you could sell a you could sell a president owned by outside interests. Bazing.
It depends where. I mean, China maybe not so much. Belgium maybe, yes, or something. I look at it from Elon Musk's perspective too. I mean, for him, this is.
I don't find it necessarily relatable.
This is a real kind of PR thing for him, right? I mean, we're talking about it right now, which means that, you know, we're thinking about Tesla. But I think he actually can deliver this because he's a guy with, like, dogged determination, and he could really do things when he says he can. I mean, it's been proven time again, so we'll see.
He can get things done. I do wonder, though, about where the PR and where the supposed philanthropy ends. Elon Musk knows how to make money, and I imagine that he'd be thinking, if this does come off, it's going to help the bank balance of various of his interests somewhere. Much as I'd like to think he's doing it purely out of solidarity with the people of Adelaide and the wider region, I rather suspect some profit motive somewhere down the line.
Well, maybe it's just a massive bluff. Maybe he just assumes, for all the reasons we've been discussing, that the government of South Australia is never going to take him up on this.
Well, no. I mean, look at what the South Australian Green Senator Sarah Hanson-Young replied to Musk. Let's talk. So she's in on it.
Yeah, the South Australian Green Party has mercifully little actual power, Danny.
Okay, well, that shows my knowledge of South Australian politics.
There's not really any reason why it needs to be especially extensive, but I don't think that right there is a contract drawn in blood.
Do you think they'll go for it?
No, to be honest, I don't. But that said, if everyone's air conditioning fails again next summer, it may be a different question. We're going to take a short break now. You are listening to Midori House here with me, Andrew Muller, Tom Edwards, Daniel Giacopelli, and Carlotta Ribello. Coming up next, we move seamlessly along to a story which also just about has enough of a South Australian angle to justify this link.
Back in February 2007, 10 long years ago, the very first edition of Monocle magazine hit newsstands. A lot has happened in the decades since. From that first office in London's Boston Place to 7 fully staffed bureaux around the world. From the humble beginnings of Issue 1 to a media brand and business producing beautiful books, magazines and 24/7 radio and podcasts, to a chain of Monocle shops selling original ranges and collaborations with our favourite brands, to Monocle films, events and sellout annual conferences. Yes, a lot has happened, and the next chapters aren't written yet. Happy birthday, Monocle, and here's to the next 10 years.
You are back with Midori House, with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Tom Edwards, Daniel Giacopelli, and Carlotta Ribello. Now, it is probable that at some point during the alleged construction of President Donald Trump's wall along the United States-Mexican border that Trump will make some reference to it being the world's longest, mightiest, or bigliest fence. He will be wrong. The world's longest fence is, along with the world's least reliable air conditioning, in South Australia. It's the 5,500-kilometre dingo-proof barrier. The actual longest actual wall is China's Great One. The question is, do they actually work? We have seen recently several troubling newspapers in the hated enemies of the people, mainstream failing pile of garbage media, have recently run slightly mischievous pieces pointing out that the Great Wall not only nearly bankrupted the Ming Dynasty, it didn't really keep the Manchus out either. Tom Edwards, is there a lesson here?
Yes, there is. They don't work.
Do they not work, though? Because
says noted military historian Thomas.
Without wishing to get into the morality of a couple of other famous walls, the Berlin Wall, from the point of view of the people who built it, kind of worked, in that it did prop Soviet communism up for several decades. The peace barrier on the West Bank, brutal, ugly, and blundering though it is, has, you know, it has stopped suicide bombers from coming from the West Bank into Israel, as has the walling off of Gaza.
No, you're correct with some excellent examples, my flippant remark. I think the point is, does it work ultimately? It depends whether you view the objective as being you know, the immediate short-term interests of a builder of said wall, or the idea, however vainglorious, that it is for all time. And often with these, especially if you go back through history,
the vainglorious thing is a recurring theme.
They tend to come with this idea of, you know, and for all time we shall repel the invading hordes, etc., etc., etc. And I just think if you look at the end game, even for those examples you cite, well, the ones that are no longer there, the general sense of celebration and the extraordinary outburst of unity that accompanies their demise, to me, delivers the sort of rebuttal to the idea that, that they work. But again, maybe I'm just a helpless romantic, Andrew.
Danny, do you have any faith in your president's, you know,
wall-building
legacy-defining project?
Well, it's not going to happen in the way that he wants it to happen. I mean, it's probably going to be half as tall. I mean, there's really great articles out there from architects saying exactly how you build a wall like this, and it costs vastly more than the government says it's going to. You have to dig really far deep so nobody could tunnel. You have to make it out of very expensive materials. It's probably not going to even be a wall in some parts. I mean, the administration has come out and said some parts of it are going to be invisible.
That's to keep out the plague of Mexican mime artists.
Exactly. But in the Great Wall of China example, I mean, it drained the Ming Dynasty's coffers. It didn't prevent people from coming over. And it actually wasn't a real wall. It was 16 kind of connected areas that they eventually connected over 2,400 years. So they didn't make this thing over 3 years. And, you know, this is in the middle of the desert, too. How are you going to get people out there? The logistics, the supply chain, it's probably not going to happen.
Well, the thing with walls is that they usually tend to appear, when you look back in history, to fix a domestic problem and to whoever's in charge to show that they're doing something about it and then just have immediate effect. And that's clearly what Trump is trying to do. You know, I promise to do something now, straight away, so let's build this great wall. You know, here in Europe, we like to say, oh, we're so against it, but the European continent hasn't been shy of that as well. I mean, even in 1995 or even 1996, it was when in the Spanish enclaves of Ceuta and Melilla in the North African coast that they decided to build a wall, which was actually partly funded by the European Union to keep off migrants, a wall that then became a second wall and a third wall because it wasn't being effective, and the bill ended up rising and rising because they had to build, in the end, three walls that still stand.
And those were, of course, a precursor to the walls that Eastern European countries have been building in the last couple of years for roughly the same purpose.
Yeah, exactly. And you also saw them in Greece when they decided to build a land border with Turkey. In that instance, they tried to argue, you know, asking the European Union for money, and no, we don't stand for that. I guess they learned their lesson.
Danny, what does it tell us that in the last couple of days, even Mitch McConnell has just given up on this mad fantasy of Donald Trump's that Mexico is actually going to pay for it itself?
I mean, come on. This has been the most ridiculous lie of them all, that they're going to make...
Oh, I don't know.
There's some competition on that front.
Yeah, steady on.
I mean, there's no way in hell Mexico... I mean, well, the kind of way that they arrived at was that they'll do it through some kind of machinations of tariffs and taxes. They'll pay for it that way. But it ended up that actually they'd be making money in the selling of kind of toasters and washing machines in the end, Mexicans would.
Like souvenir toasters or washing machines?
No, so basically
the wall on them.
They would
I went to Donald Trump's wall and all I got was this lousy washing machine.
Yeah, T-shirts, key rings, little kind of...
I can see that working. I understand you can get things made in Mexico for quite competitive rates.
My favorite thing, though, is a lot of journalists have gone to the Great Wall to investigate this, and there's this one guy who runs a museum dedicated to the Great Wall, and he actually was giving tips to the Trump administration, and he says it'd be best for Trump to dig moats and fill them with water as well. That would be his advice, because that's what they did with the Great Wall.
So he's suggesting that what's needed along the border between Mexico and the U.S. is some sort of body of water.
Yeah,
they could call it the Rio Grande.
I was going to say somewhere Grand River somewhere.
Genius.
It just strikes me that everyone's down on walls as the edifice itself. I'm not 100% anti, and there's even some world leaders who've been very hands-on with their wall building. Our own, the late great Sir Winston Churchill, one of the greatest Britons of all time, he loved his wall building. If you go to his house at Chartwell in Kent, It's surrounded by beautifully finished, expert pointer as well, fantastic fashioner of walls. It still stands to this day.
What's the point you're trying to make?
And more to the point,
they're not necessarily a bad thing. And as long as it's fashioning an enclave around, for example, an orchard or a rose garden, it's very welcome. And just don't use it to divide people.
And also, nobody ever saw any Mexicans in Winston Churchill's orchards. So, you know,
as far as I'm aware.
So there's proof they work. Let's move along now to a story about a Bolivian schnauzer dressed up as a monk, for which I have entirely failed to furnish a plausibly intellectualized context for discussing a Bolivian schnauzer dressed up as a monk. The dog in question is Friar Carmelo, adopted by the Franciscan monastery of, I don't even know where to start with that, Cochabamba? Near enough. They can complain.
Good effort.
Thank you. And subsequently compelled in turn to adopt the dress code, to the predictable delight of people on social media who should get back to damn work already. Carlotta, is this sort of arrant attention-seeking becoming for an order of Franciscan monks?
This is the best
story. They didn't have to put it on Twitter. I mean,
no, and they didn't. Someone went there and saw the dog and realized how great it was. This is the best story of 2017. I'm calling it already. In March.
What, March? You think, yes. March the 10th, 2017 has peaked with a schnauzer dressed up as a monk?
Absolutely. I mean, if this is the best story we're going to get, it's a really good year. Do you remember what happened last year? But focusing on this dog, what a nice story. And I love the fact that in Spanish, they give him the nickname Fray Bigotón, which means Friar Mustache. How good is
so,
that?
So, Tom, I know you're just itching to explain everything here, because this all day at the office, you've been showing as many people as you possibly can this story, explaining the details and why you love it so much. So,
well, I'm a fan of dogs that have a moustache or beard haircut broadly, and a miniature schnauzer obviously ticks that box.
This would be your subject on Mastermind.
Absolutely. And what pleases me particularly was that the friars in this monastery, they obviously adopted this dog. One of them had the bright idea. Apparently they had a puppet show for local children to teach them about the work of monks in the monastery. And they realised that one of the puppet outfits would perfectly fit Carmelito. I'm going to use the familiar form. They put him in it, and it was an absolute triumph. And off he waddled in his little, habit. I guess that's what you call it. I love the story. I think it's great.
You have to Google it to see the photos, though. But
exactly. It does not work perfectly on
the audio
medium. But this is great outreach. I know there's a general crisis of recruitment in the church. Bingo, you can solve it by finding a dog in a hat.
This is the semi-serious point here, Danny. Pope Francis has recently been exhorting members or officers of his church to try and find new ways to encourage recruits, because they're struggling a bit for priests and nuns and brothers and monks these days.
And the same day this happens? That's God's work.
Well, exactly. Danny, do you think the opportunity to dress schnauzers up as monks might attract more people to a life of God?
No, but on a more serious point, I think this is just going to make Republicans in the U.S. just hate this Pope much more than they already do, because they think he's this progressive. I mean, Pope Francis is...
How is dressing a schnauzer up as a monk regressive?
No, I mean the wanting
too progressive
married priests to join the priesthood. The other serious news that we were trying to talk about. We'll see how well that goes down in the more conservative areas of the world.
On the subject of serious news that you wanted to talk about, Danny, the lawyer. You were very, very keen to talk about this.
So this is
You've got about 30 seconds you can do it in.
Okay. A lawyer was representing a client who allegedly burned down something. He was on trial for arson, and the lawyer's pants started catching fire in the courtroom. And he ran
How?
Out. He
How
ran out screaming.
That? How does that? How was this spontaneous combustion?
He had an e-cigarette in his trousers, and they burned a hole through his pants. So,
and the client was convicted.
Liar, liar, pants on fire. And yeah,
that didn't help.
It didn't help.
There's no smoke without fire.
Or indeed, lawyer, lawyer, pants on fire, which is going to be the headline on every tabloid story covering
the
this
New York
one.
Post tomorrow. Check it out. That'll probably be it.
It'll be it. I mean, they've made it too easy. It is a gift for. Well, it's going to be split between that and the guy in Korea with his kids, isn't it?
Indeed.
Yeah.
We haven't even talked about that.
It
was a great day for good stories.
It is. I think we'll clear Monday's episode of Midori House for that one. For now, we do have to leave it for Midori House today. Tom Edwards, Daniel Giacopelli, and Carlotta Ribello, thank you all for joining us. Today's show was produced by Tom Hall, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Stephen Kenny. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. More music next at 1900. It's The Menu with Marcus Hippie. More on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday. Monday, 1800 London time. For now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend.